In 1975, there is a curious coalition that is born in the city of Chicago. A critic from the Chicago Tribune and a critic from the Chicago Sun-Times come together and establish a partnership around the criticism of film. And these many years later, we inherit Siskel and Ebert. Though they have left the scene some many years ago, Siskel and Ebert usher in a new way that Americans and Westerners view film. They take a lot of heat from both sides of the critical threshold. Traditional film critics say that they're sort of common humanity approach to criticism is uneducated and unstudied. And others from the amateur side of film criticism look at them and decide that it's curious that neither of them very frequently agrees with the other. And nevertheless, Siskel and Ebert deliver to Americans a new way of seeing movies. And if you ever spent time in front of them, you know that they did that with this sort of like, you know, Roman way of viewing films. A thumbs up or a thumbs down or an accommodation of this mid-level thumb. Curious creatures, Siskel and Ebert, though devoted one to another and to their partnership, are best characterized as like frenemies. About 10 years into their partnership, Warner Brothers came around and even pitched a sitcom that they were going to name Best Enemies. The sitcom fell flat and was never produced. But Siskel and Ebert delivered to us a new way of looking at film through more common opinion-based views. If you were to go back and track from the entirety of their partnership together, their predictions or their preferences on the best picture of the year, just putting them toe-to-toe, you would see, like, over the course of their 20-ish or so year partnership, they only agreed on the best film of the year like 4 or 5 times. But they have given us a particular way of viewing films. What happened after Siskel and Ebert came onto the scene is that rather than watching the trailers themselves and deciding what movie we might go see on Friday night or Sunday afternoon, Americans begin to pay attention to commentary and criticism first and decide which film they might see after they've heard the critical commentary. Usually, if you were like me, you were leaning toward one or the other personality. You were like, generally, I like what Gene Siskel likes, or for the most part, I am drawn to Roger Ebert's opinions, and you might choose film in that way. Maybe you are asking yourself right now, in your mind and in your heart, what does film criticism, particularly Siskel and Ebert, have anything to do with church on a Sunday morning? Let me tell you why I'm talking about Siskel and Ebert. We, those of us who embody church in the way that we do, in the Episcopal tradition, or even in the mainline Christian tradition, from Catholics to Presbyterians or Methodists, we inherit Scripture through the lens of a model that is similar to the lens that Siskel and Ebert have delivered to us. We get episodes of the Bible in these bite-sized chunks, and then people like me stand up and give you commentary on a particular scene. And when we do that, some of us, many of us, fail to consider the entirety of the movie. It is much more beneficial to the person of faith to have seen the movie, the whole movie first, so that the meta-narrative of the movie, the whole movie itself, might influence what we see when we look at things from scene to scene to scene. What do I mean by that? Many of you, most of you sitting in these pews, have seen the movie Star Wars, yes? It might have been decades ago, but you've seen the movie Star Wars. And you remember that curious and somewhat eccentric scene when our heroes go to that strange cantina. It's been a scene that has baffled critics, but critical commentary says that what Lucas is trying to do is demonstrate to us both the beautiful diversity of the universe and also the universe's shadowy underbelly. However, if that was the only scene from Star Wars that we've seen, or maybe another scene or two, there's no way that we, as participants in viewing that movie and pushing ourselves into the story, can come away with the sense of that the story itself tracks mythology through time. It is the hero's adventure, and that, in fact, the Force, the lightness of the universe, and then the Empire, the darkness of the universe, are at odds with one another and yet contained within the heart of each and every single one of us. We must watch the story from beginning to end in order to get a sense of the meta-narrative so that when we do the work that we do on Sunday mornings, our criticism, the opinions that we have, the commentary we make is influenced by the meta-narrative first. Now you're thinking, why, Jimmy? When we hear the words that we hear from the prophet Jeremiah, the second most prolific prophet in all of the Hebrew scriptures, one whose voice sits at the center of prophecy for Israel and then for all the Jewish Christian development that happens up until this very day, or when we listen to the poetic lyrics that we have from David, the alleged psalmist from Psalm 1, and we hear this idea that we should be like trees planted by streams of living water, and then we hear those trees grown strong and tall, creating a canopy that shades creation and creatures, compared over and against to a shrub that lives in the desert. We have this natural tendency to hear, both through our own human understanding, this broken understanding that we have of our role in the world, but also poor critical commentary over the centuries. We have this tendency to hear that, like, we are either strong, tall trees planted by streams of living water, but more likely, we're those thirsty shrubs that have been planted in the desert, unfortunately, and there's nothing we can do about that. And yet, that commentary, though it's commentary that gets made 365 days a year by biblical commentaries and preachers alike, also in the center of our own human heart, that is inconsistent with the meta-narrative of the whole movie, of the whole story itself. Let me take you back to the very beginning, Act 1, Scene 1 of the story itself, so that we might hear the meta-narrative influence this idea of being a shrub or a tree. You remember in the very first story, the storyteller says, as I told you a few weeks ago in our annual meeting, that God is hovering over chaos. God hovers over the deep, over the abyss. And that hovering is like a mother bird that hovers over a nest as she delivers food, vomits up her own meals from her stomach in order to feed her children in the nest. God hovers over chaos and brings order to creation. And after order is created, there is a judgment that takes place with each beat of creation. God hovering over the chaos, creating the order, reflects back this understanding that chaos to order is good, that there is goodness sown into creation. And then if we fast forward like a little bit after halftime, somewhere around the beginning of the third quarter of Act 1, Scene 1, humanity comes on the scene. And when humanity comes on the scene, this beautiful thing happens, right? God says to humanity, be fruitful and multiply. Now, here's the deal. If that's the only scene that you've heard out of that particular movie itself, be fruitful and multiply, then what we take away is this very disappointing and somewhat ignorant image that, like, dudes are supposed to get out there and slay the saber-toothed tiger and kill the ungulate and drag it back to the cave where women are there stirring the pot of stew while balancing as many babies as the womb will handle on her hips, and that is the reality. That is the trajectory of creation that God has ordained for us to embody. And that just makes me want to scream. That kind of exegesis is not only just poor, it is so dangerous. What we are meant to hear when we hear be fruitful and multiply is that you, humanity, you human beings, you are invited into the work that God is doing. You are invited into the work of bringing order out of chaos. It's shared work, work that people like you and I do in partnership with God. And that is the very design of creation. What we are meant to hear is that you, humanity, you in partnership with God have agency and power. You have the ability to determine things. It is your vocation. It is the very meaning of life that we human beings engage and embody the work of taking chaos and bringing order and goodness and belovedness to that very work. So then, when we listen to the words of Jeremiah, or when we hear the lyrics of the psalmist say, be like a tree planted by streams of living water, what we are meant to hear is if you find yourself as some of that sagebrush out in the very middle of Antelope Flats on a scorching August day, then dig yourself up and dig your community up with you and move yourself to the banks of the Grovant River, so that you might become a cottonwood and grow strong and tall and provide a canopy that gives shelter to creation and creatures around our community. You, humanity, have agency and power. that agency and power is multiplied in relationship with God and with each other. That's the design that comes out of the meta-narrative of Scripture. Now, I'm going to say something now. I'm going to make two more points here. And the next point that I make, I want to ask you a favor. The first favor that I ask you is assume positive intent. The second favor that I ask of you is to put me under the umbrella of mercy. That know that I come to you saying what I'm going to say with real humility. With real humility and a desire to connect with the full spectrum of reality and struggle that exists across the spectrum of creation. I am saying that each of us has the power to uproot ourselves from thirsty confines and deliver ourselves to the shores of a river where our roots might sink deeply and we might be well watered. And you, very likely, might be thinking, easy for you to say, Jimmy, and that's fair, right? I'm a white, straight guy in 2024. All privilege has been delivered to my threshold, and that privilege is real. Though I did not grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth, I most assuredly grew up with a silver scholarship in my mouth. And that afforded me an enormous amount of privilege in my life. But when I say that we might lift ourselves from places where we are thirsty and starving to places where we are well-watered and well-fed, where we can grow strong and tall, and we can provide shade and cover, I know that that might be heard from a perspective of privilege. But what I want you to know about me is that though I have been the inheritor of real beneficial privilege, I have for some reason always lived my life as a heart-forward person. And I can tell you from the perspective of being a heart-forward person that the chaos that exists in creation itself, whether it is the microeconomy of human relationships that exist within our dysfunctional families, or it is the macroeconomy of human relationship that is systems of oppression and injustice in poverty, I want you to know that for some reason, I have always felt that pain. I continue to feel it today as I hold it in close relationship with my relationship to God and my understanding of goodness that flows through the universe. What I can tell you as human beings, we are perennial losers and we are eternal winners. And that is a weird reality in which we find ourselves living, but it is nevertheless real. I am telling you, I see it and I feel it. So please don't hear this as a message that drips with privilege, but one that doesn't lean backwards to time that we're more ordered, but leans through the chaos that we are experiencing now into the fog, forward with the expectation that we in relationship with God will find new order, goodness, and love again. And that, in fact, is the vocation that we are meant to embody. When I was a high school kid, I used to literally pray to God, God, please let me not feel the things that I feel. I would even say, God, make me more like my brother, who just seems to move through life with relative ease, unbothered by the suffering of the world, and also unable to access the world's great joy and blessing, but just tends to have this like meat and potatoes experience in life. And when I think back on that, you know, from the view that 54 gives you, I think to myself, like, thank God, God did not answer that prayer. The great privilege of being empathic feelers and compassionate, faithful people is so important for unified work that we do as a community of faith. So don't hear what I am not saying. We don't look naively to some, you know, toxically positive future. We, as people of faith, ground ourselves in the chaos and grab each other arm in arm, those empowered and those disempowered, and we hang together with the expectation that love comes again. Now, I need to make one more point, and I think this is important, because preachers like me, month in and month out, year in and year out, give theological commentary on the nature of humanity and the nature of God, but we never give you a sense of, like, if you were inclined, if you found yourself on the threshold, leaning heart forward toward what I'm saying, then how in the heck would you get there? How do we do this? You have no doubt heard it said before, this phrase that comes back to me time and time again when one of you is struggling. You report back to me with this phrase, well, Jimmy, you know God never gives us more than we can handle. And what I usually say to that is, like, that is the biggest load of crap I have ever heard in my entire life. There is so much theologically inconsistent and wrong with that reality that I just want to disavow you of that right now. It might help in the moment. It might help you on your own to be like a little grittier or a little more resilient when you are struggling, but it is absolutely toxic for two reasons. One, it gives us this image that God is like up there in the sky at one end of the conveyor belt, dropping packages of sorrow and woe and dropping packages of great blessing and joy that just happen to get delivered randomly to our thresholds, rather than this image that the first storyteller tells us in the first story of God hovering over us like a mother providing sacrificially out of her stomach so that we might be fed, so that we are drawn out of chaos into goodness. What I would also say about the second phrase in that particular terrible piece of toxic wisdom is this idea that we have to do it on our own. It's an absurdity. It does not exist in the narrative itself. Now, I am well aware of our own, like, inner Mountain West American values of pull yourself up by your bootstraps or cowboy up. I have a sense of that in my life. And look, I have benefited from engaging in practices that would grow my resilience and create grit within my own life. But what I am here to tell you is God does not expect you to do anything by yourself, on your own. God is always there, reaching out in partnership, one to another. So when people say, like, God never gives you anything more than you can handle, oftentimes I was like, anything more than God can handle. But I can tell you from my life, God has so frequently, so regularly, and so confoundingly given me more than I can handle that I can't even count how many times it's happened. And I have created within myself a practice of just turning it over, like literally turning it over. Okay, God, like here we are. One more of those moments where like I have come to my end and I need you to step in. And I need you not to just encourage me, not to give me a piece of advice, not to breadcrumb me. I need you to carry me here because I am lost and I am at my end. And I know you have no end. And I know that you love me. That's my first piece of advice. When you find yourself there, at your very end, then just say it. Say it out loud. Say it as frankly and deliberately and straightforwardly as you can. Okay, God, that's it. Time's up for me. You do what you do here. Hover over me. Feed me. Bring order and goodness and love out of the chaos that I am experiencing. One more piece of advice. If you find yourself on the threshold of wondering, like, I like what he's saying, I think it scares me, I don't really know what to do, I'm going to encourage you to start in a place that maybe is a bit counterintuitive. Many times when we're starting new things, we're like, start small, start something that you're good at. Like, make sure that you can create some successes and have some wins and then build on those wins. I'm telling you the opposite. Here's where you start. What are you most afraid of? What scares the absolute crap out of you? What makes you so scared that you have the follow-up thought of like, I'm going to push that out of my mind because I don't even want to think about it. It's so scary. That's where you start. You start by befriending chaos, that fearful, anxious chaos in the midst of engaging or re-engaging the relationship that you have with God, meeting God in the most fearful and anxious parts of our lives is the very beginning of reorder and goodness and love. Amen.